what has happened where we can't even go to Thanksgiving dinner with our uncle because you end up in some weird fight that is unnecessary. Well, it's true. These guys are just weird. And it is. You know, they're running for He-Man Women Haters Club or something. That's what they go at. That's not what people are interested in.
I don't know about that, Tim Walz. I'd vote for them for the head of the He-Man Women Haters Club.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling there's something right.
Well, it is today.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Tomorrow, maybe another
and
story.
I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, and Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle, Washington on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and oh look, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. Well done, Minnesota. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets and the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman. Your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Voters headed to the polls on Tuesday in four states for congressional and state primaries. In Kansas, my old home state of Missouri, Washington State, and the critical battleground state of Michigan. We will, however, have coverage on our next broadcast of any noteworthy results and or problems for voters at the polls. But today, well, we've got quite a bit of history to keep up with, Desi Doyen.
Yes, we do.
First, we start here. Vice President Kamala Harris, a daughter of immigrants who rose through the California political and law enforcement ranks to become the first female vice president in U.S. history, formally secured the Democratic presidential nomination on Monday night, becoming the first woman of color to lead a major party ticket. More than 4 years after her first attempt at the presidency itself, Harris's selection as her party's standard bearer caps a tumultuous several weeks, to say the least, for Democrats and, well, everyone else in this nation, prompted by President Joe Biden's disastrous June debate performance. Just as soon as Biden abruptly ended his candidacy, Harris and her team worked to secure backing from the 1,976 party delegates needed to clinch the nomination in a formal online roll call vote. Her nomination became official after a five-day round of online balloting by Democratic National Convention delegates that ended on Monday night. The party said it would next formally certify the vote before holding a celebratory roll call at the party's convention later this month in Chicago. Now, normally, we might spend some time today underscoring such an historic event, but it seems that Harris has sort of stepped on her own historic moment today with her announcement of her vice presidential pick, which was, to her credit, I think, as far as campaign discipline goes, successfully kept a secret until her own unveiling of her own choice on Tuesday morning.
That's quite a feat just by itself.
It is. And actually, I think it speaks well so far to the organization of her campaign that they were able to shut their traps until they were, you know, wanted to actually make the official announcement. And that official announcement is that Vice President Harris has officially selected Minnesota's very progressive and very likable Governor Tim Walz as her vice presidential running mate, adding a popular Midwestern state executive to this year's Democratic ticket. Harris's campaign on Tuesday morning called Walz, quote, a battle-tested leader who has an incredible track record of getting things done for Minnesota's families. In picking Walz, who's in his second term as governor after serving six terms in the U.S. House prior to that, Harris will have as her number two someone with a record of winning over white working class voters in Rust Belt states, including in rural areas of Rust Belt states, while also boasting a robustly progressive record. Walz was born and raised in Nebraska. He enlisted in the Army National Guard when he was 17 years old. He served for more than two decades there with both domestic and overseas deployments. After serving some 24 years in the Guard, he rose to Command Sergeant Major, one of the highest enlisted ranks in the military. He later became a high school social studies teacher and a football coach in Mankato, Minnesota, about 80 miles south of Minneapolis, before he won a congressional seat in a largely rural and agricultural district in 2006, flipping that seat from red to blue. When he first ran for Congress back in 2006, this was one of his radio ads introducing himself to Minnesota voters at the time.
Hi, my name is Tim Walz, and I'm running for Congress here in southern Minnesota for several important reasons. But today I'd like to tell you about one issue that's very personal to me. I am a retired Command Sergeant Major in the Minnesota National Guard, and after years of firing artillery, I sustained severe inner ear damage. Because I have good health insurance provided through my employer, I was able to have surgery on my ear. As my ear healed, my hearing was gradually restored. One morning, several weeks after the surgery, I awoke to a sound I couldn't identify. I asked my wife what I was hearing, and she told me, Tim, that's your four-year-old daughter, Hope. You see, Hope wakes up singing every morning, but I had never heard that sound until that day. I'm running for Congress because I believe we as a country have a moral obligation to ensure that every father can hear his daughter sing, that every citizen receives the best care our medical community has to offer. I'm Tim Walz, and I approve this message because I've heard how important health care is to everyone.
Well, that's it. The election's over at that point. Man,
yeah, it gets me every time I hear it.
It really does. Walz would go on to represent Minnesota's first congressional district for 12 years before his successful run for governor in 2018 when he ran on the theme of One Minnesota, and he won that race by more than 11 points. As governor, Walz had to find ways to work in his first term with a legislature that was split between a Democratic-controlled House and a Republican-led Senate. Minnesota has a history of divided government, though, and the arrangement was surprisingly productive in his first year. He then easily won re-election in 22 as state Democrats also kept control of the House and flipped the Senate to win full control of both chambers and the governor's office for the first time in years. The Dobbs decision reversing the constitutional right to an abortion has been credited for both that flip and Walz's easy re-election. With trifecta control, Walz and other Democrats went into the 2023 legislative session with an ambitious agenda and a whopping $17.5 billion budget surplus to fund it. Their proudest accomplishment included sweeping protection for abortion rights that included the elimination of nearly all restrictions that Republicans had enacted in prior years. They also enacted new protections for trans rights, making the state a refuge for families escaping increasingly big government restrictions for personal medical care in so-called red states. His allies have spoken frequently about how his background representing rural communities is much needed in the Democratic Party, noting that he won re-election in a red trending district, one that was about evenly divided in 2012 but swung heavily to Trump in 2016. Yet Walz was re-elected to Congress that year anyway. He also had the most Capitol Hill experience of anyone on Harris's reported shortlist, with relationships in Congress that could help a new president move a legislative agenda. As governor, Walz has overseen a bonanza of progressive policy accomplishments. I mentioned protection for abortion rights, legalizing recreational marijuana, restricting gun access, providing legal refuge to trans youths. Walz also enacted laws expanding paid family leave, banning most non-compete agreements, providing universal school meals, breakfast and lunch for all students, regardless of family income. And he capped the price of insulin in Minnesota 3 years before the Biden administration did it nationally. All part of a legislative wins that his colleagues and supporters have said would translate nationally. We will see. Well, maybe. In recent days, Walz has turned up the publicity dial. He's trying out attack lines against Trump and Senator J.D. Vance in a slew of media appearances, including on Fox News, which personally is one of the reasons that I was pulling for someone like California Governor Gavin Newsom or Treasury Secretary Pete Buttigieg, because they have a proven record of being, you know, willing to step into the lion's den of disinformation that is Fox News and right-wing media, and not only withstand the attacks, but turn them back against their opponents. Well, Walz apparently has developed a similar reputation. In a late July interview on MSNBC's Morning Joe, now famously, I think, Walz ripped Trump and Vance as, quote, weird, which seems to have struck a chord, struck a bit of a nerve with Republicans, and a chord with Democrats, as an angle of attack that the GOP ticket seems so far to have had a very difficult time rebutting. After which Harris herself began using the weird line almost immediately. Here's Walz during that interview invoking, I think, the first known broadcast use of that line of attack against the Republicans.
Their policies are what destroyed rural America. They've divided us. They're in our exam rooms. They're telling us what books to read. And I think what Kamala Harris knows is bringing people together around the shared values, strong public schools, strong labor unions that create the middle class, healthcare that's affordable and accessible. Those are the things. You look what they're talking about. They went right to division. They did not give us a plan on health care. Donald Trump talked about infrastructure. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris built bridges, built roads. So I think this is going back to the bread and butter, getting away from this division. We do not like what has happened where we can't even go to Thanksgiving dinner with our uncle because you end up in some weird fight that is unnecessary. And I think bringing back people together, well, it's true. These guys are just weird. And it's, you know, they're running for He-Man Women Haters Club or something. That's what they go at. That's not what people are interested in. And there is angst because robber barons like J.D. Vance and Donald Trump gutted the Midwest, told us we didn't do that. They talk about private schools. Where in the heck are you going to find a private school in a town of 400. Those are public schools. Those are great teachers that are out there making a difference and gave us an opportunity to succeed. That angst that J.D. Vance talks about in Hillbilly Elegy, none of my hillbilly cousins went to Yale, and none of them went on to be adventure capitalists or whatever. It's not who people really are.
In response to the announcement of Walz as Kamala Harris's running mate, the pro-Trump super PAC MAGA Inc. immediately painted Walz as, quote, incompetent, and called him and Harris, quote, both far-left radicals that don't know how to govern. Well, Walz's record as governor would seem to suggest otherwise, as do, by the way, a ton of video clips of this guy, both governing, speaking to the Minnesota legislature, signing bills, et cetera, as well as running for governor, some of which we'll try to share with you in the days ahead. Caroline Leavitt, the Trump's campaign press secretary, tried out this line in response on Tuesday, quote, it's no surprise that San Francisco liberal Kamala Harris wants West Coast wannabe Tim Walz as her running mate. Walz has spent his governorship trying to reshape Minnesota in the image of the Golden State. She added, Walz is obsessed with spreading California's dangerously liberal agenda far and wide, which seems an odd line of attack against the guy born and raised in Nebraska before he enlisted in the National Guard for 24 years at age 17, then represented Minnesota for 12 years in the House and as governor for two terms. But we will ask our guest today, the great John Nichols about that kind of bizarre line of attack, if you ask me, when he joins us momentarily. As we go to air, Harris and Walls will be making their first appearance together in Philadelphia, a bit of a feint that made many of us think that she would be naming Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro as her running mate before the two will then embark on planned visits to some seven states over the next 5 days, though appearances planned for Georgia and North Carolina may need to be rescheduled due to, let's say, inclement weather from Hurricane Debbie, as we will cover in Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report later this hour. So, Desiree, before we go to John, your response today to the selection of Tim Walz as the Democratic VP?
Well, actually, I'm quite delighted. I did not want to get invested in whoever was going to be maybe, you know, one person or another, because I didn't want to be disappointed, but secretly, I was kind of hoping it would be Walls, because
really?
I think he's really a good leader, a good communicator, I should say an excellent communicator. And I just think that he, over all of these, you know, these great candidates, a very deep bench for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. But I thought he overall was the best choice, not just because he would be good at campaigning, but because of actual leadership. I mean, the job will be to take over as president if necessary, and I think he can handle that.
I think when you saw the news this morning, you saw it before I did and before I even knew, you know, who it was, you told me that you found it funny, as I recall, or
no,
it made you laugh?
I laughed.
Why did you say that?
Because I was glad to see it.
You know, but I think what may have been triggered there is that Tim Walz is likable.
Yeah.
So, you know, say whatever you want about his policies, he comes across as a nice, funny, likable guy, which so far is also how Kamala Harris, I think, is coming across in just over the 2 weeks since she was endorsed by Joe Biden to become the standard bearer. They seem to be nice, Harris and Walz. And you know, after all of these years of mean Trump and now his mean new running mate, J.D. Vance, I think niceness and likability, even apart from their policies, could really be the ticket to the White House in this country, exhausted by the meanness and the drama from the Trump years. You know, just two normal people who aren't weird. Des, before we take a break and get to John, I know it's early still as we all scramble to get to know Tim Walz, but what do you know about his record on climate for the moment?
Well, let's just go straight to when he was reelected as governor, and he got a trifecta in the state legislature as well in 2022. So after that, he signed an impressive number of progressive policies into law, including a 100% clean energy law, a new transportation planning law, clean energy permitting reform, and a groundbreaking green bank. That's something under the Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority. And so green banks that are administered by states are actually essential to implementing the Inflation Reduction Act climate policies in order to give the kinds of loans that regular commercial banks won't give to help communities get more resilient for climate change.
No doubt more on that and his climate record in the days ahead and the Green News reports ahead. But for now, let's take a quick break and we'll come back to get some thoughts on all of this from the great progressive journalist and author John Nichols, who's been trying to get the nation to focus on Tim Walz for quite some time, it seems to me. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, now. not be a weirdo, but the other two seem to be. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The late Paul Wellstone used to say that he represented the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. As the nation's John Nichols reports today, the progressive senator from Minnesota wanted to distinguish himself from the compromising new Democrats who sought to move the party away from a focus on economic and racial justice and toward a more centrist, corporate-friendly agenda. After Wellstone died in a plane crash shortly before the 2002 election, in which he was expected to win a third term and perhaps emerge as an anti-Iraq war peace candidate in the 2004 presidential race, his family and friends established Camp Wellstone to train a new generation of progressive leaders. One of the early graduates of the camp's 2.5-day campaigns and elections course was a then 41-year-old high school geography teacher and football coach from a small southern Minnesota city named Tim Walls. As Nichols writes, the faculty advisor for the Gay Straight Alliance at the school, Walls was a decorated command sergeant major in the National Guard who had gotten involved in politics back in 2004 as a district coordinator for the Vets for Kerry group that championed the candidacy of Democrat John Kerry in the 2004 presidential race. That, writes Nichols, wasn't a classic political resume, but Walls was undeterred. With his Camp Wellstone training, he announced an unlikely bid to defeat six-term incumbent Republican Representative Gil Gutnecht in the 2006 midterms. Running in a rural district where Democrats had struggled for years, Walls campaigned in a folksy, self-deprecating, Minnesota nice style that charmed voters while at the same time pushing a common-sense agenda that won workers and farmers back to the ballot line of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale and, yes, Paul Wellstone. In one of the biggest surprise results of the 2006 election season, Walls won his first campaign by a 53-47 margin, yes, in a previously so-called red district, and he headed to Washington. Now, 18 years later, as the two-term Democratic governor of Minnesota, Walls has won another campaign to become the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States. Joining us now is the legendary progressive journalist John Nichols. I just made you legendary, John. He is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and as a Badger State native, associate editor of his local Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times. He's also the author and co-author of many books on progressive politics, including It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, written with a guy named Bernie Sanders. Oh, John Nichols, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, Brad, I can see Minnesota from my house.
I guess you can. Listen, I think you were the first guy to bring Tim Walls to my attention some years ago. I can't recall if it was when he first ran for governor in 2018 or before his reelection bid, when you tipped me off to the progressive policies that Minnesota would be able to enact if they were able to pick up trifecta control of the state house, Senate, governor's mansion, which they did. But I'm pretty sure it was you who pointed me first towards Walls either way. You've also seemingly been campaigning for him to be the vice presidential pick in your Twitter feed in recent days. So, John, as a longtime progressive and neighbor to Minnesota there in Wisconsin, what are your general thoughts today, first on Walls himself and second as Kamala Harris's choice for VP?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good, Brad.
I guess you are. Yeah.
Look, I don't know if I was campaigning for Walls or just doing what I did with you, which was trying to help people to get a perspective on this guy, to get a sense of who he is and where he's coming from, because he is, kind of an outsider on the national political scene. Mm. As of a couple weeks ago, it's safe to say that, 99 out of 100 Americans couldn't have identified him out of a lineup. And so in a very short amount of time, this guy has come not from the mainstream inner circle of the elite Washington Democratic Party. But from way outside, up on the up on the border with Canada. And so I think there was a lot that people needed to understand quickly about the guy. And that's one of the reasons why I posted a lot of those old campaign ads and videos so that people could understand he didn't just appear out of nowhere.
Yeah.
This is kind of an amazing political figure.
Yep.
And what's amazing about him is best summed up by the first ad that he ever ran. Remember, this is a guy who was a high school geography teacher and coach.
Yep.
Who kind of got energized by the 2004 presidential campaign. He was part of Vets for Kerry. He's a National Guard, longtime National Guard guy. And he was very offended by the attacks on John Kerry in 2004. So he got active then. He went to Camp Wellstone, a camp set up by friends and allies and family of former Senator Paul Wellstone, the great Minnesota progressive, to train young candidates. He shows up, he gets some training, and then out of the blue, he announces candidacy for Congress in a district where Democrats have been losing for years. And he didn't even have a primary opponent because everybody's like, who wants that nomination, right?
Right.
So he starts campaigning as this teacher, you know, and coach going across this very huge rural district. And his first ad is a, I believe, a radio ad. And in it, he says, you know, I'm Tim Walz, you know, a little bit of biography. He says, I was in the National Guard, and I, you know, one of the things I did was shoot off artillery.
Yep.
And that was tough on my ears. And eventually I found out I was losing my hearing. But because I'm a teacher with a good union contract and a good health care plan, I got surgery on my ears. They started a treatment to, you know, restore my hearing. It started coming back.
Yeah.
One morning I woke up in my bed and I heard a sound. I turned to my wife and I said, what's that sound? And my wife said, that's your four-year-old daughter singing.
We played that ad in the previous segment, and I got to tell you, I mean, it just brings
tears to your eyes.
It does. I mean, all of these years later, hearing it two or three times, every time it plays, man. I mean,
because
this,
it's such a brilliant way to explain
a
national health care plan.
Yep.
And that's my point.
Yep.
Tim Walz, for whatever reason, you know, whether he's born in Nebraska, raised in, you know, or came up in rural Minnesota, you know, whatever it is in his history.
Yeah.
He figured out how to talk to people.
Yeah.
About issues that a lot of people shut down on.
And you see that in, because, you know, we've been reviewing all kinds of video and, you know, things. Some of, I think you had posted a link from your article at The Nation today toward his comments in the Minnesota State House about gun safety and what they were going to do.
Yep.
I mean, he's really a remarkable orator. Not necessarily in the way that maybe Barack Obama was, but in the way that he just sort of relates to people. He seems like a family member when you watch him. John, and I got more that I want to ask you about Walz specifically, but because this is our first time that we've spoken since Joe Biden dropped out of the race to endorse his vice president for the top of the ticket, I want to get your thoughts very quickly on Kamala herself from a progressive point of view and how she's acquitted herself during this, I think it's fair to say, 2.5 week or so honeymoon period that's since taking over at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, it's look, as you, I think, know, I've interviewed her many times and gotten to know her pretty well over the last few years. Not so much when she was running for president in 2020. But as vice president, and it's been an interesting experience because many of our conversations have been quite lengthy. I've been interviewing a lot about her childhood, her upbringing. Maybe might even write a book there at some point. But what's interesting about it is that she is someone with deep politics. She was raised in a very, very political family. She up in the anti-apartheid movement. She's somebody who knows what you know and what I know. You know what I mean? She's read the books. She's been there.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that she's necessarily as progressive as I am. or as progressive as you are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's come to be who she is,
mm-hmm.
but she's got an understanding of it. And I think there's a fascinating thing with her, and that is she's 60 years old, or roughly 60 years old, and yet constantly evolving, growing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a rare commodity, if you will, a rare reality.
Mm.
And it's one of the reasons why many people had an impression of her in 2019, 2020 as somebody who ran for president, but didn't work out so well. Well, as somebody who's constantly growing, she got that vice presidential role. She wasn't given a lot of perks, you know, sent off to do some of the hardest jobs in the administration, but she kept learning and growing and developing her skills, appearing at every union convention, going out there to every rally for abortion rights, you know, basically being the campaigner of the Biden administration, whereas Biden's in the White House a lot, she's out on the road. And so I think the bottom line on this, Brad, is she, when the moment came, she was incredibly ready.
Yeah.
And that's why this 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks has worked so well, because, you know, she, it wasn't that she anticipated necessarily it was going to happen, but when it did happen, she was far more prepared than I think a lot of the pundits and a lot of the insiders knew.
Yeah. She rose to the moment, as I had actually suspected that she would. And, you know, as to, you know, learning and changing along the way, maybe credit where it's due, because Joe Biden, after his, you know, decades in Washington, did appear as well to learn and change along the way to sort of meet the time, to step up and meet the times, it seems to me. Regarding your interviews with Kamala, I will look forward to a book on that and on her, because I want to hear about, you know, when she decided to turn black. But until then... I think it will become the stuff of sort of legend, whether it's true or not, at least if the Democratic ticket wins here. But how much of her selection after years of failed attack lines against Trump, you know, and really from Republicans and Democrats alike against Trump, but how much of her selection of him was based simply on the, you know, him sort of cracking the code of a way to actually attack Trump, to get under his skin and under Republican skin by simply dismissing him and his running mate, J.D. Vance, as simply weird? I mean, was that a part of this?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it was. You know what I mean? Because you're right. There is a code that Democrats have been trying to crack for a long time. They're like, how do we talk about Trump?
Right.
Right. And a lot of the way that they've talked about him is this terrifying figure. Right. This very, very dangerous figure.
Right. Right.
And, you know, look, there's a lot about him that is unsettling.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. But what Walls figured out, I think, in a very deep, small town Midwestern way, is that the most effective way to take on the bully, take on the guy who's trying to sort of overwhelm you.
Yeah.
Is to say he's weird.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like he's something about him that's not right.
Well, it's going from being mean. You know, Donald Trump is very mean, and it seems like trying to be mean to him back does not work. But if you sort of laugh him off, you know, sort of marginalize him that way, it kind of seems to drive them crazy.
Well, and I think you're right. And I think we've got to put these two pieces together, okay? Kamala Harris coming up as a candidate who was ready for this race, and Tim Walz coming up as a candidate who was ready for this race, right? Each of them bringing something to it. So I think that the key to this thing begins with the fact that Trump really does believe in a cult of personality, right? He's made the Republican Party that. And so when he looked at the Democratic Party, he couldn't possibly imagine that he would be running against anything other than the Biden-Harris ticket, right? That wouldn't change.
Right.
That Biden would never give up the leadership of the party, right? Never give up the candidacy. Well, Biden isn't a cult of personality guy.
Mm-hmm.
He did give it up. That threw Trump off in ways. I mean, I think Trump is still destabilized simply by that reality.
Yep.
And then comes the immense success of Harris's first few weeks as a candidate, right? that throws Trump off even more.
Yeah.
You saw the NABJ appearance, which was a desperate attempt to get back in the news with that absurd line about, you know, Harris, you know, like becoming black when in fact she's identified as black throughout her life. And so he just stumbled horribly there. And then comes this, you know, good humored guy out of the Midwest who is totally capable about talking about how to fix a tractor, right? Yeah. Or how to repair your car engine.
Right.
Somebody who really does speak to a lot of the people Trump has tried to speak to. But instead of speaking to those people in the Trumpish language, right? I'm a billionaire from New York who knows things you don't know.
Right.
Right. Tim Walz comes along and says, you know, I'm a teacher from Mankato and I know a lot of the things you know.
Right.
Maybe I've had a chance to get a little closer to government, to be a member of Congress and to be the governor, but I get you. I get what you need. And I'm telling you, you're not going to get it from a weirdo.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's like the whole conversation has changed. Biden stands down, Harris stands up. And then she chooses a running mate who is absolutely ready to deliver the messaging to some of the key swing groups in America.
Yeah.
So suddenly it's a whole different world. And the Republicans are frankly going crazy.
And seemingly delivering the message to those people that Donald Trump kind of wishes he could. He wants to be that everyman. He wants to be that guy who, or at least he wants to come across as that guy who can fix the tractor. But everyone knows, you know, he's never even ridden on a tractor, much less know how to fix it, man.
Rarely seen one.
Yeah. Now, just on a practical political level, Walz was, you know, seemingly also picked to help shore up the blue wall industrial states of Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania as a longtime native son of Wisconsin. Does that actually have an effect on Wisconsinites, or is that more of a, you know, sort of a nice biographical storytelling narrative, but not necessarily
It has an impact. Yes, of course. Look
on actual boots on the ground voters in Rust Belt states like Wisconsin, that means something to them?
Tomorrow afternoon, where are Tim Walz and Kamala Harris going to be? In Eau Claire, Wisconsin. In northwestern Wisconsin, literally an hour's drive from Minnesota, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people in that part of Wisconsin actually watch Minnesota TV. They know Tim Walz.
Ah.
Some of them may know Tim Walz better than they know their own governor, Tony Evers.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not Eau Claire. Eau Claire's got its own TV.
Right.
But as you go west of it toward that border, and you know, some of those parts of Wisconsin over there literally are in the Minneapolis media market. There's other parts of Wisconsin that, you know, up around Duluth and Superior, that are in the Duluth TV market.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a bleed, if you will, between Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Okay.
Those parts of this country know one another. Now, that doesn't necessarily, I mean, we Wisconsinites tease Minnesotans because they're so braggy. They claim they've got we have land of 10,000 lakes. Well, we have more lakes in Wisconsin, but we don't brag about it, right? You know,
and I see.
So there are those differences between us.
Uh-huh.
However, if you know how to win Southern Minnesota in a congressional campaign, then you've got a good insight on how to win Western Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
If you win Western Wisconsin, if you get a good vote out of Western Wisconsin, you carry the state. Because you got the strong vote out of Milwaukee, you got the strong vote out of Madison, but what you need is a strong vote out of the western tier of the state, right? Those farm and small city counties that are frankly places that used to vote for progressives, right? Back in the 30s and 40s, but that have not always loved the National Democratic Party. Now, here's the interesting thing. Some people say, oh, they fell out with the National Democratic Party because it became too liberal. Wrong. In many cases, they fell out because it became too centrist and corporate.
Mm.
These are counties that voted overwhelmingly for Bernie Sanders when he ran for president. And so this is a place where if Tim Walz takes that good-humored, small-town, thoughtful progressivism and takes it out to places like that,
it's, you know, a big deal politically.
Let me ask you, I got 3 points I want to try to get thoughts from you before we get a go here. Trump mm-hmm. finished just 1.5 percentage points behind Hillary Clinton in Minnesota back in 2016. Biden.
Oh, it was a close race.
Yeah. Biden carried it by more than 7 points in 2020. And by the way, Trump has apparently taken to falsely claiming that he actually won the state of Minnesota last time and that he will do it again. but I think a lot of us thought that the choice was likely to be Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, since Pennsylvania seems like really the most difficult of the three blue wall states, Wisconsin, Michigan and Pennsylvania, to shore up. What do you make of her decision to not choose the popular Pennsylvania governor in this case?
Yeah, look, the one thing to understand about Josh Shapiro is he's telegenic. He's a very effective speaker. He has won big in a battleground state.
Mm-hmm.
He is a longtime Barack Obama ally. In mm-hmm. fact, somebody's very, very close to Barack Obama and learned a lot from Obama, right? So had he joined the ticket, and I know there's been criticisms of him, we can go as deep into that as you want, but had Shapiro joined the ticket, he would have been an effective member of the ticket. And he would have been effective, especially in winning Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Winning a battleground state is a big deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, make your case there, and that's all good. I have differences with Shapiro on a number of issues, including his support for school vouchers. I think some of the things he said about Gaza protests were, you know, way over the top. And so, you know, yeah, you can have your criticisms. But the fact of the matter is, he would have added to the ticket. I don't think there's any question of that. But the thing to understand is that what Kamala Harris did, her kind of genius here, was she said, look, I'm going to be the nominee. I've only got 2 weeks, but I'm going to open this thing up and let all these candidates compete. I'm going to let them all mm-hmm. make their best case, not just to me, but to the party and to the nation.
Right.
You know, and in that competition, Shapiro made his best case. And I think, you know, won some people over, but they tended to be more traditional, kind of a lot of more of the insider DC types who are like, oh yeah, he checks these boxes, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Whereas Walz went a very different route. He went out there to the whole country, to the whole party, and he said, these guys are weird.
Right.
Republicans are, and he, in a 2 week period, think about what Walz did, create a viral moment, right? With the use of the word weird.
Yep.
Right. Everybody picked up on it. He did all these appearances on different cable shows where they were just sending him around his videos. They're like, wow, look at this guy. He really knows how to talk about this stuff.
Yep.
And then people started to dig in deeper. Labor leaders started to say, you know what? Now that we look at the record, he's probably our best ally among governors in the country, with the possible exception of Whitmer in Michigan. And so all of these pieces started to come together. And that's, I think, what Harris ultimately decided was running an election campaign is about moving from one place to another, moving from a place of strength to a place of greater strength. And my sense is that Walz did a better job of that during the 2 weeks, better than any of the other prospects. He effectively won the virtual primary.
John Nichols, as AP reports today, Walz, quote, drew praise from lawmakers as ideologically diverse as progressive leader Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and independent Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a far-right
yep.
conservative former Democrat who left the party earlier this year. What should we take from this? You know, a guy who appeals to both AOC and Joe Manchin? Does that mean we will be instrumental in helping to unify a somewhat fractured Democratic Party? And B, does he stand a chance of actually helping to, you know, actually win over Republican voters to the Democratic ticket?
Absolutely. I think Harris is already winning over Republicans. When there's actually a pretty active Republicans for Harris movement with people announcing endorsements left and right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something going on there already.
Mm.
I think Walz helps in that regard. And again, I'll go back to that thing about Walz actually knows how to fix the engine of a car.
Right.
You know, I mean, he's done videos. I don't know if you've seen them.
Yep.
Where, like on the campaign trail, where he's holding up the, you know, one of the little pieces that's used to make sure the light works in a car, and, and it wasn't working. So they stopped at a Napa Auto Parts and actually fixed it.
Right.
And I think that somebody like a Joe Manchin, or even some, you know, some of the more moderate, more sensible Republicans out around the country, they're like, okay, that's actually real.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it's not, and not put on. It's not John Kerry trying to go duck hunting or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
I was,
yeah, John Kerry showed up in Western Wisconsin to you know, shore up his credentials as a hunter, wearing clothing that was so lovely that that one farmer I talked to literally said, "I think that guy's clothes are more expensive than my house."
Last question, John. I was just wildly amused by this earlier today. I saw that the Trump campaign's response to the naming of Walz as the Democratic choice for Veep, it just cracked me up, but I would love to get your thoughts on it. They said, quote, "It's no surprise that San Francisco liberal Kamala Harris wants West Coast wannabe Tim Walz as her running mate. Walz has spent his governorship trying to reshape Minnesota in the image of the Golden State. Walz is obsessed with spreading California's dangerously liberal agenda far and wide." Now, as a very happy California resident myself, John, that sounds good to me, but it seems to be just wildly out of touch with reality when it comes to Tim Walz, no?
When it takes you 2 minutes to explain the attack,
yes,
it's not a good attack.
Right.
You know, when you're like, well, we don't like Tim Walz because he's from Minnesota, but he likes California, and he's trying to make Minnesota like California, which is bad, even though California is called the Golden State.
Right.
You know, it's like a ridiculous fantasy. And also, this is the problem that the desperate Republicans have at this point. If you say, oh yeah, Tim Walz, he's a California wannabe, and then you put up a picture of Tim Walz, I'm sorry, he doesn't really look the part.
You mean this
looks like what he is?
This guy from born and raised in Nebraska and then spent about 3 or 4 decades in Minnesota isn't
much
actually
of it in rural Minnesota,
right?
Yeah. Isn't and really was very happy and comfortable there.
A California wannabe seems like he could have just come on out if that's what he really wanted. Anyway, John, yes. I got to get out. It has been a delight talking to you today. For a happy change, I look forward to more such discussions over the coming weeks and months here. Of course, check out John's article today at The Nation, headlined "Why Walz Won." I will link, of course, to that when we post today's show at brandblog.com. John is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, contributing writer for The Progressive, associate editor of The Capital Times, and author of many fine books, including "It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism," with Bernie Sanders, his co-author. You can find him at, of course, thenation.com and on the site still known as Twitter at Nichols Uprising. Thanks, John.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you.
Thank you, sir. All right.
Sorry, I just have to say, it's just delightful. I'm really enjoying Republicans flailing around as they try to attack good, decent leaders and failing.
Well, enjoy it while it lasts.
Yes.
Because it may not last forever.
True.
But it is kind of fun. Yes, you might as well. You deserve it, Desi Doyen, after the hell that we've been put through over the past, I don't know how many weeks. Frankly, I don't know how many years at this point. So it is nice, as I said earlier, it is nice just to see some likable people running for office, running for the White House. Okay, let's take a quick break here, and we will, Desi Doyen's Green News Report is straight ahead. A lot to cover there today,
yes,
as well. As noted, by the way, Harris and Walz are out on their magical mystery tour, kicking off in Philadelphia, going through a lot of swing states, though not, I think, through Georgia, thanks to Hurricane Debbie. We will discuss all of that straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay right there. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back. I should note that our we had our Green News report in the can today before we learned about who Kamala Harris's running mate will be. In case you haven't heard the news, that would be Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, whose climate record you briefly outlined at the top of the show. I'm sure we will have more about that in future Green News reports. But for now, here we go. Our latest Green News report.
30 inches of rain means what for certain communities here?
It means obliteration for a lot of our city.
Hurricane Debbie brings astonishing rains and flooding to Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. Climate change is a partner in the Paris Summer Olympics. Plus, plaintiffs in last year's catastrophic Maui fires reach a settlement with Hawaiian Electric.
All of those catastrophes and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Yeah, and this storm is getting a lot of attention, even though it is just a Category 1 storm.
Oh, it's only a Category 1. Is that right, CBS News? No worries about those 30 inches of rain and cars floating away. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we had a few weeks respite from the storm season, but boy, has it kicked into gear again, it looks like.
Yes, it has. Hurricane Debbie made landfall as a Category 1 in Florida's Big Bend region on Monday.
Oh, only a Category 1?
Yes, but it had lots and lots of rain and flooding.
Oh.
It hit only about 20 miles from where Hurricane Idalia struck last year. As we go to air, Debbie has now been downgraded to a tropical storm, but it dumped at least 19 inches of rain in Florida and is blamed for killing at least 4 people. Storm surge of as much as 10 feet in some places, compounded with inland flooding to cut off communities and overwhelm infrastructure. Because Tropical Storm Debbie is very slow moving, forecasters warn that it is potentially a nightmare scenario for flooding, with historic rainfall totals of as much as 30 inches as it creeps across to low-lying areas in Georgia and South Carolina over coming days. The mayor of Savannah, Georgia, Van Johnson, did not mince words when speaking with CBS News in advance of the storm.
30 inches of rain means what for certain communities here?
It means obliteration for a lot of our city.
What goes through your heart, through your mind?
Pray. Pray.
Man-made global warming is supercharging storms like Debbie in a number of ways. Debbie is unusually early in the storm season, fueled by record warm ocean waters. Normally, a second named hurricane doesn't form until the end of August. Rising sea levels have raised the baseline for storm surge. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, intensifying Debbie's rainfall. And studies show that storms today are moving more slowly after landfall than they did back in the 1950s.
Really?
And are stalling in place more often, giving them much more time to dump much more rain.
That's not good.
Emerging science links the slowdown of storms to the melting of Arctic sea ice, which is altering the jet stream that drives weather systems across the U.S.
Yeah, but it's only a Category 1, so who cares? What's on the Olympics?
Well, climate change is also a partner at the Summer Olympics.
Damn it.
You know, that heat dome that has brought scorching temperatures across Western Europe and North Africa and is broiling athletes and spectators alike at the Paris Olympics would not have been possible without the influence of man-made global warming. That is according to a new rapid analysis by scientists at the World Weather Attribution Group. Polluted runoff from unusually heavy rains is still causing fluctuating water quality issues in the River Seine. Belgium withdrew some of its triathlon teams after its competitors, who swam in the river, fell ill. On the plus side, a years-long effort by Paris city leaders to expand public transit options and build a network of safe bike lanes and create a citywide low-cost bike share system has made Paris the first ever 100% cyclable games, with no car needed. That has paid off in a major reduction in traffic congestion and the side benefit of cleaner air.
Unless, of course, you can't ride a bicycle, but we'll leave that for another day.
Well, you can still take a car, you just don't have to.
Okay.
In other news, nearly 1 year after the catastrophic fires in Maui, Hawaii, plaintiffs have reached a $4 billion settlement announced by Hawaii Governor Josh Green. If approved by a court, electric utility Hawaiian Electric would pay about half of that $4 billion settlement. Hawaiian Electric was criticized for failing to shut down its power lines during the dangerous wind conditions that contributed to the blaze. The utility and other defendants did not admit to any legal liability as part of the settlement. At least 102 people died in the devastating fires that ripped through the town of Lahaina and other parts of Maui on August 8, 2023, destroying the historic town and causing damage estimated at $5 billion.
And, of course, no amount of money can ever restore that.
And finally, some better-ish news. Oil and gas major BP predicts that the world's demand for oil will peak next year as wind and solar power and electric vehicle adoption continue to surge. But BP projects that demand for fossil natural gas will continue to grow over coming decades.
So they hope. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I say a little prayer for you.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Thanks to our guest today, the nation's John Nichols, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We hope you made it worth your while. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit one of those donate buttons or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us keep it free for all, no paywall, hopefully ever, at the Brad Blog, thanks to those of you who support our work.
And help us stay on your public airwaves. They belong to you.
I think tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken, Digby and Driftglass joining us?
Yes.
Is that right? So mm-hmm. We're sort of taking a progressive turn around the horn, so to speak. We'll get their thoughts on Tim Walz and
all the things that have been happening.
All the things. Amazing times we live in. Interesting times, as the Chinese curse says.
A little more interesting than I think most of us would like, but yeah.
Anyway, all right, got to get out. Thanks again, Des. Thanks to all of you. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebook, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Yeah.